Welcome to a History of Horror podcast, a year-long journey through films throughout the decades, examining across the globe what makes us scared. My name's Christopher Brown. In 2002, director Mick Garris invited some director's friends to a dinner at a restaurant in California. There were 10 people there that night. John Carpenter, Larry Cohen, Don Coscarelli, Joe Dante, Guillermo del Toro, Stuart Gordon, Toby Hooper, John Landis, Bill Malone, and Garris. They had a nice time. You know, those stories shared between people who'd made horror films, effectively, and mutual admiration for people's work. Del Toro coined the name for the group in jest, the Masters of Horror, when he told at a nearby diner celebrating her birthday, the Masters of Horror wished her a happy birthday. Subsequently, Garris organised regular dinners with the group and invited other horror and genre directors to attend, including Dario Argento, Eli Roth, David Cronenberg, Tim Sullivan, Rob Zombie, Bryan Singer, Fred Decker, William Lostigan, Lucky McGee, Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, James Gunn, Miri Lambert, Ty West, Lloyd Kaufman, among others. Now, we're going to talk about a lot of these people further down the line. And some of you would argue that the club shouldn't really have had Garris in there himself, along with some of the characters who barely make horror films. That said, the term Masters of Horror is an interesting one. All these people made horror in the US, although not all American, and certainly not a definitive list either, but they all create a certain kind of horror. One a lot of us are nostalgic for today. Many will argue that a lot of these directors are not as good as they were. A lot would argue that many of them just aren't very good at anything, and certainly calling them a master would be untruthful. That said, they all come from or are influenced by a period of time between 1968 and 1984. Modern US horror was born by somebody who wasn't at that table and a man who still makes films and writes stories today. George A. Romero was born in New York City, borough of the Bronx, to a Cuban-born father and a Lithuanian-American mother. His father was a commercial artist, and Romero attended Pittsburgh Carnegie Mellon University. After graduating in 1960, he began his career shooting short films and commercials. One of his early commercial films, a segment for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which Mr. Rogers underwent a tonsillectomy, inspired Romero to go into horror film business. He, along with his 9 friends, formed Image 10 Productions in the late 1960s and produced a film. That film was Night of the Living Dead. The movie, directed by Romero and co-written by John A. Russo, became a cult classic and defined modern horror cinema. Romero was inspired not just by the stories of Richard Matheson's I Am Legend, but also by classic cinema itself, kind of showing what could be possible with the camera. In particular, Robert K. Elder's The Tales of Hoffman. He said of that film, it was the filmmaking, the fantasy. The fact it was a fantasy and it had a new, frightening sort of bizarre things in it. It was everything. It really was a movie for me. And it gave me an early appreciation for the power of visual media, the fact you could experiment with it. It was doing all these tricks in camera and it was sort of obvious. That made me feel that, gee, maybe I could figure that mis medium out. It was transparent and it worked. He mainly directed, before Night of the Living Dead, he mainly focused on TV commercials and industrial films for the company he built, which was Latent Image. According to Romero, they wanted to capitalise on the film industry's thirst for the bizarre. He and Steiner contacted Carl Hardman and Marilyn Eastman, president and vice president respectively, of Pittsburgh-based industrial film firm called Hardman Associates, pitched their idea for then an untitled horror film. Convinced by Romero, a production company called Image 10 was formed. The initial budget was $6,000, with each investing $600 of their own money for a share of the profits. When they've discovered that they needed another $6,000, they got another 10 investors. In the end, they had to raise $114,000 for the budget. But what that small budget did was define how the film was built and why it looks the way it does. According to Hardman, he said, "We knew that we could not raise enough money to shoot a film on a par with the classic horror films with which we'd grown up. The best that we could do was to place our cast in a remote spot and then bring horror to be visited on them in that spot." It was filmed in Evans City in Pennsylvania, 35 miles north of Pittsburgh. It's actually rural country. Props and special effects had to be simple because of the budget again. Blood was Bosco chocolate syrup drizzled over cast members' bodies. The flesh was merely roasted ham and entrails donated by one of the actors who also owned a chain of butcher shops. Costumes were second-hand clothes from cast members and goodwill. Zombie makeup varied depending on how much money they thought they had and the makeup they could create. You can actually tell where the scenes were shot in the process because early doors, people were just painted white with dark rings around their eyes. But they got clever as time went on, using mortician's wax as their skills improved. And they were able to simulate wounds and decay to make the zombies look more frightening. What was pivotal to this was also the fact that, and what means he could get away with such a low budget, was that Romero decided to film in 35mm black and white. It gave the film a documentary style and also a feel of being almost guerrilla. There's a sense of realism about Night of the Living Dead, benefited from its rural location, its unusual mixed cast, and also the fact that it's set in one night and it's sold as such. You're locked in for an evening with these characters in this location, and that benefits the story greatly. It feels as much like an examination of changes in American social society as it does a film about the ghouls coming out from the dead. Night of the Living Dead started George A. Romero's career, and he continued to make films. He continues to make films to this day. He actually writes comic books now, I think. But he works on some shorts, and then he did films like Season of the Witch, which bombed. There's Always Vanilla, which bombed. The Crazies, which did okay, but was low budget. Martin, which is now seen as a modern classic, but didn't do well at the time. Dawn of the Dead, which was his next zombie film, kind of crystallized and also forced the zombie genre to be what it is today. Between that and Zombie 2, also known as Zombie Flesh Eaters in the UK, those two movies that came out a year apart from each other, but weren't influenced by each other, apart from the marketing for Zombie Flesh Eaters, kind of hinted at Zombie 2, and they also tagged on some US stuff to kind of capitalise on Dawn of the Dead's success. But really, they were two separate movies, and they kind of kickstarted how we now see zombie films. Romero was influenced by the films we've spoken about in the 1950s. Science fiction and horror. Black and white. Stark. But also things that can be done in camera. So, writer Stephen Miller says, "Romero's director style is a revival of 50s schlock shock, and the Army General's television discussion of military operations in the film echoes the often inevitable calling in of the Army in 50s horror films." Let's talk about Night of the Living Dead. Romero himself says, "The film opens with a situation that has already disintegrated to the point of little hope, and it moves progressively forward towards absolute despair and ultimate tragedy."
Welcome into a night of total terror. Night of the living dead, the dead who live on living flesh. The dead whose haunted souls hunt the living. The living whose bodies are the only food for these ungodly creatures. Night of the living dead. Our adventure in fear. An experience in shock more shattering than your strangest nightmare. Night of the living dead. A night with the dead who cannot die. A night of total terror. Night of the living dead. Welcome to a night of total terror. Night of the living dead. The dead who live on living flesh. The dead whose haunted souls hunt the living. The living whose bodies are the only food for these ungodly creatures. Night of the living dead. Watering than your strangest nightmare.
Okay, so normally, and I think this is how we know how cinema changed at this point. Night of the Living Dead was a year zero moment for horror in the US. Now, we're going to dance back and forth when we talk about ghost stories and that kind of thing in American horror. But to give you some idea exactly how it kind of snapped people's heads back, nationally, the film was shown as a Saturday afternoon matinee. Well, now, this was typical for horror films at the time, so it attracted an audience, a young audience, of people looking for something to do on a Saturday afternoon. The MPAA's film rating system was not in place until November of that year, so even young children were not prohibited from buying tickets. Roger Ebert at the Chicago Sun chided theatre owners and parents who allowed children access to the film with such posters, potent content. Kids were unprepared for it, but generally everyone was unprepared for a film like this. I don't think the younger kids really knew what hit them, he said. They were used to going to movies, sure, and they'd seen some horror films before, sure, but this was something else. It had an immediate effect on the audience. The kids in the audience were stunned. There was almost complete silence. The movie had stopped being delightfully scary almost halfway through and had become unexpectedly terrifying. There was a little girl across the aisle from me, maybe 9 years old, who was sitting very still in her seat and crying. It's hard to remember what sort of effect this movie might have had on you when you were 6 or 7. But try to remember, at that age, kids take the events on the screen seriously and they identify fiercely with the hero. When the hero is killed, that's not an unhappy ending but a tragic one. Nobody got out alive. It's just over. That's all. Okay, so Variety went deep end angry at this. They said, "Till the Supreme Court establishes clear-cut guidelines for the pornography of violence, Night of the Living Dead will serve nicely as an outer limit definition by example. In a mere 90 minutes, this horror film, pun intended, casts serious aspersions on the integrity and social responsibility of its Pittsburgh-based makers, distributor Walter Reed, the film industry as a whole, and exhibitors who booked the picture. as well as raising doubts about the future of the regional cinema movement and of the moral health of filmgoers who cheerfully opt for this unrelieved orgy of sadism. It was a dawn. Not a dawn of the dead. You got that later. But what it did show was completely and utterly explode what people thought horror could be. First off, it defines what a zombie was. While a zombie word is never used in the film, they actually call the monsters ghouls, which is used a lot in the 50s when it comes to these kind of monsters. But Romero introduced the idea of zombies as reanimated, flesh-eating cannibals. It moves people away from this idea of voodoo witch doctors, for example. And, people under the benefits of hypnosis, kind of rising from their graves to attack the living. You could argue it ushered in splatter, certainly to the mainstream. Herschel Gordon Lewis brought splatter to the drive-ins and grindhouses with Blood Feast, but that was a cheap, jovial, wink-at-the-camera, light version of splatter in comparison to this far darker, literally and also in the juice of lighting, version. What Romero managed to do finally, before we move on, is point to a world where horror is no longer in gothic castles. It's no longer an alien invasion. It's real in your home, in rural and suburban America. And Romero was able, therefore, to show that exploitation in a home place has far more power to shock than in maybe the gothic castles where a lot of exploitation was before. You can see this again and again in the slasher films, which we're going to talk about shortly. These are ideas that he basically managed to crystallise again with Dawn in 1977, I think it's fair to say. By the time he'd rocked around today in 85, he'd kind of moved on in terms of what he wanted to do with the zombie film. Small locations and apocalypse way beyond probably the comprehension of most, into the realms of arguments between scientists and army. But Dawn's about people who are holed up in a shopping mall at a time when shopping malls were quite rare, and about their interactions locking themselves away in a world of consumerism when in the outside world it's a very dangerous and very different place. John Carpenter, another main name in this, and certainly somebody who, again, well, he kickstarts the genre really on his own, despite not actually creating it, and also creates some seminal 1980s horror films, despite not actually being that that good at the box office. So John Carpenter was born in 1948, a director, music composer, and screenwriter. And to be fair, he has worked in lots of different genres, although he is mainly known for horror and sci-fi. Most of Carpenter's films, it's fair to say, though, are critical and commercial failures, despite their now routine love that they get. An ongoing argument that we have that horror films are almost always reassessed further down the line as being important, when at the time they're not, and seen as a bit trashy. But Carpenter did make Carpenter made films that were successful. Halloween, Escape from New York, and Starman, to name three. Tower of the Dark Star, Assault on Precinct 13, The Fog, The Thing, Christine, Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, They Live, are now cult classics, and Carpenter has been acknowledged for his influence, if not his commercial box office acumen. He started off and wrote and directed an 8-minute short film called Captain Voyeur. It's really noticeable only because once it got resurfaced in 2011 from the USC archives, became clear that he'd already had certain ideas in terms of points of view and horror, which were resurfaced almost 10 years later in his film Halloween. He's worked as a co-writer, film editor, music composer on The Resurrection of Bronco Billy, which won an Oscar for Best Live Action Short Film. It actually toured theatrically as well because of its award. His first film was a sci-fi comedy, Dark Star, which he'd co-wrote with Dan O'Bannon. He then went on to write Alien. Apparently the film was hard to make because they had no money. So the solution was to multitask and do lots of the jobs themselves. So he edited, wrote, produced, directed, and also did the score. Well, O'Bannon acted in the film and did the special effects. Which also meant that George Lucas enjoyed his work, Dan O'Bannon's work, and got him in to do some work on Star Wars. Assault on Precinct 13 is our jump off point, I think, from George A. Romero. Romero's film is a siege movie where the monsters outside are effectively what would be, you know, the Indians in an old Western. Rio Bravo would be a good example of that kind of film. It's the same influence as to Carpenter for this. To save money again, Carpenter wrote, directed and scored it, but also edited the film under John T. Chance's name, the name of John Wayne's character in Rio Bravo, a direct nod. One of the things he did, which was very clever, was to bring in a group of very experienced actors that people might not know, which added to this kind of documentary feel and a feel of you wouldn't know who would get killed off or not and who's the stars. It was a clever move because he had a strong group of people to work with while simultaneously not necessarily highlighting where the deaths are going to be. Halloween, I suppose, where we need to talk to in terms of Carpenter. It kick-started the slasher boom, which ran from 1978 to 1984. It was spoofed mercilessly in Scream in 1996. Originally, it was an idea suggested by producer Erwin Yablans. And it was about a babysitter being menaced by a stalker. That's not an original idea, has to be said. The British film Fright is a run on the old urban legend of the phone call coming in from the a room in the house. Carpenter took the idea and another suggestion to take place during Halloween and developed a story. Carpenter said of the concept, Halloween night has never been a theme in a film. My idea was to do an old haunted house movie. The music was inspired by Dario Argento's Suspiria, and which also influenced the film's colour palette and William Friedkin's The Exorcist. The budget was small for a film of this type, filmed in this way, at $320,000. But grossed $65 million initially, making it one of the most successful independent films of all time. Carpenter describes Halloween as true crass exploitation. I decided to make a film I would love to have seen as a kid, full of cheap tricks like a haunted house at a fair, where you walk down the corridor and things jump out at you.
Halloween night. A small American town. 15 years ago.
Michael?
Halloween.
I spent 8 years trying to reach him. and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil. I think he'll come back.
Exploring uncharted territory.
And totally charted.
Just talk.
Sure, sure.
The only reason she babysits is to have
a... Halloween.
Okay, Linda. Come on out.
After Halloween, Carpenter directed The Fog with a much higher budget than $1 million, but again it made $21 million. It's not as popular possibly as Halloween with fans, but it does have its fans and it has got a certain cult appeal. I love it. Escape from New York was also a success. The Thing bombed initially, but is now seen as one of his career high watermarks, a tale of paranoia in a frozen waste. And we spoke about the film it's based on, The Thing from Another World, before. Unfortunately, apparently, it came out the same time as E.T., and people wanted their aliens that summer to be cuddly and not slimy and violent. From there, he made Christine, an adaptation of Stephen King's book, playing up on the comedy. Starman, which got favourable reviews and is a lot calmer and quieter than a lot of his work. Big Trouble Little China bombed. Prince of Darkness didn't do much better. They Live got a cult audience, but was never really the success it was designed to be. Carpenter was offered The Exorcist 3, but wisely turned it down. And then, you know, his career has been doing odds and sods since then. Some bits more successful than others. Certainly that's considered his patch, his time period, when he's at his creative prime. Which is fair enough. You know, I mean, a lot of these people we talk about start solidly and then kind of fade away. Romero is the same. When we talk about Dario Argento, when we talk about Italian horror, soon we'll certainly be kind of having out those kind of conversations about how things have shifted and changed. Toby Hooper is another example of somebody who was able to kickstart this kind of feel. Again, working in low budget and with limited resources and completely doing something, seeing horror very much in the same way that Romero did as well. But Hooper was able to really crank the violence and use a 16mm colour to his advantage. He directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 1974. And that is a film that includes the heat. It's very much of its place. It's horror in the backwoods, again, in Texas, on a rural location, much like Night of the Living Dead. It's deliberately not as violent as you think it is, but pushes the boundaries of what you expect to see far more. For me, the landmark and outstanding moment of Texas Chainsaw is when the girl is pulled into the butcher's area of the house and the door slams shut. Now, in a different horror film, we would expect the scene to cut to the our family members or our friends, as it is in the story, who are would be looking for her or asking where she's gone. Not in Texas Chainsaw. Instead, what we do is we see her getting hooked up onto a hook while our monster appears to carve her up. And it's that flip change, that flick of the switch, that moment of shouting that this is different to what you expect it to be, that this is more. That's where Hooper's skill really comes in. And the film, after that, you can get away with a lot more narratively, such as this the over-the-top dinner scene, and the fact that the last 30 minutes is really just one person being terrorised by family, one of which happens to be holding a chainsaw and running for like 30 minutes. That actually gave it film. People always think that Texas Chainsaw got problems with censorship in the UK because of its violence. The reality was that the censors were far more concerned with how long it took to kind of just focused on one woman's terror, which seems odd when we speak about it now, because is that surely not the point of the film?
What happened was true. The most bizarre and brutal series of crimes in America. This is the movie that is just as real, just as close.
Save me! You gotta make it stop!
Just as terrifying as being there.
Please, please.
Even if one of them survives, what will be left? The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. After you stop screaming, you'll start talking about it.
If you play that film in a cinema now, and that scene where she kind of runs from one side of the screen to the other, and it's a very long shot, if anything, it gets people laugh. It's a bit of a laugh now because it's just so extreme and so long, and it's kind of almost too much. But at the time, it was very much seen as being right on the edge of what was acceptable. Hooper is traditionally known as somebody who, you know, made a couple of good films and then struggled. He made stuff for Canon, which is awful, you know, exploitation, obviously, because that's what Canon made, including Life Force, which is a better film than you think it is, but not as good as it needs to be, I think it's fair to say. I mean, ultimately, it is a film about space vampires, and therefore, naked space vampires at that. And therefore, you know, we can't really expect too much high art. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 in 86 is deliberately plays up to what were comedic elements in Texas Chainsaw. Although a lot of people, I think, would argue that Texas Chainsaw, despite what Hooper says, is certainly not a comedy. also during this 80s time and the creation of a very different type of horror, but also playing up on nostalgic elements as Joe Dante. Dante actually started his career working for Roger Corman. He worked as an editor on films like Grand Theft Auto, for co-directing Hollywood Boulevard with Alan Arkush. He created Roger Corman's produced Piranha, which was a B-movie take on Jaws, in truth. He directed bits of... But Dante's skill is different to the stuff that we were talking about with Hooper. He moves... He's more like a John Carpenter in the fact that he's far better at playing up to genre and comedy. Whereas Hooper tried for comedy, and some of it kind of fell flat because he was obsessed with the grotesque. Dante's starting point is comedy, and then he plays up to the grotesque elements. He worked on, for example, when you look at Dante's segment for Twilight Zone, the movie, his version of It's a Good Life features cartoon special effects and real day-glow colours rather than kind of a far bleaker tone that you could have gone with that story. Certainly the original Twilight Zone episode is far more dark than this, but it's still scary, but it's played up for laughs in a comedy way. Gremlins is another example of a film that kind of treads the line between comedy and violence. It's a kid's film, allegedly, but a quite violent one. And also, by the time he comes around 6 years later to Gremlins 2, he's completely blown out all the horror elements, focusing entirely on the violence. And the comedy, I should say, not the violence at all. There's some nasty moments in it, such as a gremlin being shredded, but really, it's all played for goo rather than for anything more horrifying than that. I think for me, Dante's career can be, and where he comes from can be encapsulated in the 1950s and 60s, and his love affair for cinema and for that time that we spoke about with Night of the Living Dead, traumatizing those kids and the theatre owners that put it on with Matinee. Set in the 1960s, it's a film which nods to B-movies and the showmen who made them. It says, it's about a story of a theatre owner who tries to get people in with a monster movie called Mant. Playing up to 60s cliches and 1950s B-movie tropes.
How could such a thing happen, Dr. Grabow?
The ant's saliva must have gotten into Bill's bloodstream and gone straight to his brain, just as the radiation, which is measured in units called Rentgens, was released.
And that's how he became a...
Mant.
Gotcha! For the kids of Key West, Florida, there was nothing scarier than a monster matinee.
Lawrence Woolsey, the master of movie horror, exterminates you with Mant.
The story of Mant is based on scientific fact, on theories that have appeared in national magazines.
But in the fall of 1962...
A series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on the island of Cuba.
They got the biggest scare of all.
They're gonna bomb us?
The country is on red alert.
And what a perfect time to open a new horror movie.
That'd be the best show to take a girl to.
The whole world's gonna blow up anyway, so we should just do whatever we want.
You know, last guy she went out with in reform school?
He did teach me a lot.
What about?
About my body.
Think if the bomb were about to fall, she'd do it with me.
Wait till you see the feelers on this thing.
Uno, dos, one, two, tres, cuatro.
Some of it's stage lighting. Some of it's magic show stuff. But the big studios, none of them have anything like it.
You never, ever turn one above six.
This is it!
From Joe Dante, director of Gremlins.
You see what he's putting back? The showmanship.
The ball!
bombs are falling!
You think this is some kind of picnic for me?
I'm still concerned about that bomb thing.
A little question of taste?
No, but your younger patrons, you could have some seat wetness.
John Goodman.
I love this business.
Matinee.
Man, I've seen this twice.
He's still working. The whole plays up to its 3D use and is a solid, again, horror story for younger people, if I'm being honest. Certainly for, you know, teenagers. I saw it on a Saturday matinee, because as these things should be seen, filled with kids, and people just did not know what to expect from it at all. It's frightening. It's actually quite frightening for young'uns, but safe in a way, because, you know, it's still kids and all that. So we had the kids had to be walked out because they were crying and, you know, good old screams and popcorn flying in the air. It was a great experience, and it's still, you know, like a lot of cinema, when you put it in front of the right audience, it just works really well, and it did. And currently, the trailer for his new film, a kind of a comedy horror called Burying the Ex, about a man who, his girlfriend, who's like quite a controlling person, dies suddenly, and then comes back as a zombie to kind of control his life some more. You could argue that Stuart Gordon comes from a similar school of directors who play up to the comedic elements. Reanimator in particular. He worked with Brian Usner to make a film that was funny and deliberately pastiche of, again, mad scientist films, 1950s B-movies, but had more to it than that, and also some quite shocking scenes as well, and very gory scenes. But on the whole, it is, however, a film that's designed to be a lot of fun. He also did some other stuff. He's well known for working with stories that are heavily influenced by H.P. Lovecraft, obviously Reanimator being one of them, but also things like Castle Freaks from Beyond and Dagon. He also did Dreams in the Witch House 4, which is what we hadn't mentioned, actually. These Masters of Horror's Nights became a TV series, two 13-episode runs, variable quality for Showtime. I think that Cigarette Burns is probably John Carpenter's best thing he's done in a long time. However, Stuart Gordon's Dreams in the Witch House is poor. But, you know, these things happen. And with any anthology run, you're always going to get variable quality. He also worked in sci-fi, Stuart Gordon, with Robot Jocks and Fortress, which have both kind of got a classic, cult classic feel to it. He actually worked with Usner and Ed Neha to co-create Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which is, and he executive produced the sequel Honey, I Blew Up the Kids, which is, again, a film that's well loved now. It's got, like, you know, Rick Moranis' kids and an adventure movie playing on, again, old 1950s tropes, mad scientists and kids having to find their way home, and, you know, a blade of grass or an ant can be a huge, terrifying option. But as it's Disney, it's kind of not played for the frightening elements. It's not The Incredible Shrinking Man. Instead, it's a fun family romp. Probably the best thing Stuart Gordon's done in the last 10 years is Stuck, which is an exploitation film taken about a nurse who hits a vagrant with her car, and the vagrant gets stuck in the windscreen. It's a concept movie, but played for B-movie exploitation, and as such, is excellent. I'm going to talk about one more of these so-called masters of horror. A guy who came from grindhouse roots, has played comedy and horror and genre, and kind of created a lot of the icons we're going to talk about moving forwards. Wes Craven really started, I mean, he originally, you know, he started out in porn, in reality. His role, Deep Throat is mentioned. I say role like it's his cock. It's not his cock. It's, he was, his, you know, he did film medicine and whatever. He did start out in pornography and White Coaters. Because when he originally went to do Last House on the Left, it was originally envisioned as a porno. And then instead it kind of awkwardly plays between horror and comedy. That was in 1972. So post Living Dead, pre Texas Chainsaw. And it sits uncomfortably between comedy and horror and truth, and its obvious exploitation roots. We're going to talk about Grindhouse and stuff like that at a different point. In the same way, I've jumped over Americans' obsession with ghost stories to focus on these kind of elements. We'll touch on all that later on in our journey. You could argue that Wes Craven is obsessed with reality. Nightmare on Elm Street deals with the consequences of dreams moving into real life.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
You could just see cuts happening.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Peter!
Is the coroner got to say?
He's in the John puking since he saw it.
You're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy? There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails,
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive.
Help me, please! Who are you?
From Wes Craven, director of The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left, a new masterpiece in fantasy terror, Nightmare on Elm Street.
The Serpents and the Rainbow talks about a man who struggles to differentiate between reality and his fantasy. And Scream is postmodernism in terms of being a horror film, but referencing continually horror films. He worked with Sean S. Cunningham a lot. Now, Cunningham made Friday the 13th after he made Last House on the Left. But he also worked on A Nightmare on Elm Street. And obviously, Freddy vs. Jason as well, which is the horrible clash between two icons. Now, what have we created here? What are we actually talking about? Let's start by kind of saying, right, so these filmmakers invariably created genres or icons. And now the horror icon comes from this time. And it's something we still kind of try and do now. So, but they created the template for how American horror is almost created now. Low budget and then kind of cranking up budgets to big franchises. And franchises, I mean, in the same way that Universal Pictures were doing franchises in the 1930s. So, let's take, for example, Halloween. No, actually, that's not. Let's take Nightmare on Elm Street. Elm Street starts as a low-budget horror film in 1984 about a burnt paedophile who is trying to kill kids in their sleep. So you have fear of sleep paralysis and whether you're dreaming or not. And you have a man, effectively, with razor blades on his fingers who wants to kill you. And there's very little you can do to get away because you have no sanctuary because you can't fall asleep. That is a clever, well-taught taut idea. Incredibly well produced in terms of its concepts, and it's genuinely frightening. So it spawns a sequel and another sequel. And by the time we get to Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 6, Freddy's Dead, which features a 3D ending, and people having, and you know, gags really, and a strange kind of futuristic world. It's gone daft and silly and fun and just jokey, and then has to get rebooted into something more serious by Wes Craven for New Nightmare. And this is something that's repeated again and again with horror. Friday the 13th, I mean, Jason wasn't even the baddie in Friday the 13th. Do you need those three films in total for like the Jason Voorhees creation is done over a trilogy of films in truth. But by the time we get to Jason X, we've got slasher movie in space. And all this kind of idea of the slasher film is eventually mercilessly satirized in Scream, which itself becomes a cliche as we get to Scream 4 and now a Scream TV series as well. And I'd like to say that this is something that isn't happening anymore, but it blatantly is. Let's take, for example, Oren Peli, who is probably in truth, well, there's three people, you could argue, four if you include Rob Zombie, who are this generation of what, I'm saying masters of horror loosely because I know people disagree with me on whether these people are masters of anything at all. But Rob Zombie and Eli Roth, Zombie has made big budget horror films of varying degrees of success. I don't think the world needed another Halloween 3 from him, but I know it was on the table for him for a while, which they wanted to do in 3D, which gives you, it's exactly the same thing again, cycle again. But, you know, for me, House of a Thousand Corpses is a low-budget, well-put-together horror film that plays up to cartoon success. I actually really like The Devil's Rejects. I'm not keen on it, pretty much anything else he's done. Eli Roth, Cabin Fever is a fine film. Hostel, I think, is better than people give it credit for. And now he seems to be struggling to get anything out. With Green Inferno, there's obviously licensing issues. And he's got this Keanu Reeves, I think it's meant to be a home invasion movie, but I don't really know what it is, which is playing well in festivals, but isn't popping up yet. I think it's going to go straight to video, if I'm being honest. Oren Peli is probably a better example. He's gone from, or James Wan as well. James Wan started on Saw, which was a $1 million low-budget horror film, which was a Seven ripoff, which spawned numerous sequels, a incredibly convoluted plot, which I still don't really understand in terms of who's doing what and why, over seven films or eight films. I don't even know how many Saw films there are. There's talk of a remake already. It got re-released for its 10th Saw, original Saw got re-released for its anniversary, but that film, that original film, which is quite a tight, unpleasant little horror film, is a million miles away from the, again in 3D, overarching action film that is the last chapter of that franchise. Oren Peli's Paranormal Activity actually sat on a shelf for 2 years when it got picked up by a distributor. They re-filmed the ending to make it sequel friendly and more violent, and spawned numerous sequels again of varying quality, and also kickstarted what can only be described as a seemingly interminable number of found footage films, which has led to Peli being almost a cliche of himself, that his Area 51 movie, which sat on the shelf for a long time, could be good. I haven't seen it yet, but it's basically it's all in found footage, but it starts with them breaking into Area 51 before the aliens get involved, which is a nice enough idea. But unfortunately, everyone's so sick of found footage, it's gone straight to video on demand. how we see these people is based on how we see that period of time in horror. I would argue that John Carpenter made a lot of great films. Joe Dante made a lot of great kids' films that are quite scary. Stuart Gordon reanimates a good film, although it doesn't play that well anymore for a lot of people, although I quite like it, still enjoy its successes. Then you've got Romero, who has made great films, but generally is as hit and miss as any of these directors. So this idea of these masters of horror, again, and I can't underestimate this enough, masters in the sense that they make horror films in America, not masters in the sense that they're the best, because they're not. Dario Argento is on that list of masters, but you know, so I think that's a bit harsh, and I know I've deliberately teased a lot of these people out, but really what we're talking about here, I think, and the reason why a lot of this is put in such high regard, is that, you know, I'm in my 30s, I grew up with Carpenter, I grew up with Romero. For me, Dawn of the Dead was one of the ground zero moments for me just falling in love with horror cinema. And therefore, despite his faults, Romero can do no wrong in my book. And I will argue for some of his films that people will look at me like I've got two heads. I think the only one I'll, you know, out of his dead movies, the only one I won't give you is Survival. I can't argue Survival's in a terrible film, although I haven't watched it in a long time. But I'll argue Diary, and I'll argue Land of the Dead till I'm blue in the face, and you're wrong. And I will definitely get into why those two films are important, or good examples anyway, of cinema when we talk about post 9/11 and its effect, and that particular moment's effect on horror, which we're going to get to in the future. But let's look finally at our masters, our group of people who were able to build horror films that really grabbed the public's attention, imagination, and created icons, in truth, of horror cinema. And regardless of whether you think these are the best directors or I've just randomly spouted a load of people that you might have grown up with, what they gave was the prototype for how all American horror is now, and basically starting small and building franchises. Right, well, thanks for that. I wonder how this is going to sound. This is a bit of an odd one. It's going to go long, isn't it? Yeah, well, maybe not. It's going to be quite long, but it'll be okay. We'll do it in one episode. Thanks for listening. And thanks for coming. If you want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is historyofhorrorpodcast@gmail.com. Go to historyofhorrorpodcast.com and you can enjoy a number of exciting videos and also all the other podcasts and what we're doing next coming up. You can get me on Twitter as well, which is @orange_monkey, and I'm not gonna lie, any kind of reviews on iTunes will be most appreciated. And on that line, thanks very much to the Nuthouse for the review on the US iTunes, which is why I didn't thank him before, because I hadn't spotted it. Brilliant. Okay, so we spoke about Dario Argento and Fulci, and I had to do. I've called this episode Italian Copies for next week, and that seems harsh because the best stuff about Italy and Italian filmmaking is the stuff they did not copy. But we will explain that and go into detail about the wonders of Italian exploitation cinema in 2 weeks' time. So until then, take care, speak to you soon. Goodbye.